Hello and welcome to The Leap of Faith. Well, the onset of winter is a time for conferences and seminars. We've news tonight of two different events you might like to attend. One this Sunday, the other next Wednesday. More on that in a moment. Well, it's been a week where we've heard that research suggests that Pope Francis did not do enough to address abuse in Ireland. The research published this week by Queen's University Belfast spoke with 800 people in mid-September, three quarters of whom identified themselves as Catholic. The research also revealed that 8 out of 10 surveyed didn't attend any of the events surrounding the visit, and around 40% didn't go because the travel or walking involved was too difficult. For many not attending, indifference seems to have trumped anger. That's according to the principal researcher, Dr. Gladys Ganiel. The BBC this week reported that police in Britain have recorded a surge in hate crime directed at people in England and Wales because of their religious beliefs. Most religious hate crime, over half of all offences, was aimed at Muslims. Here in Ireland, according to a recent report launched by the Irish Council of Civil Liberties, we may have the highest rates of hate crime against people of African background and transgender people in the EU. Ireland currently is one of a small number of EU countries that does not have specific laws around dealing with hate crimes. Also this week, Pope Francis has made saints of the murdered Salvadoran Archbishop Oscar Romero and Pope Paul VI, both Archbishop Romero, who was shot by a right-wing death squad while saying Mass in 1980, and Pope Paul, who guided the Church through the Second Vatican Council, were contested figures within and without the Church. And in a major religious split, the Russian Orthodox Church has cut ties with the body seen as the spiritual authority of the world's Orthodox Christians. The row is being described as the greatest Orthodox split since the break with Catholicism in 1054. But first this evening, we turn our attention to the Good Summit, which takes place next Tuesday and Wednesday in Trinity College in Dublin. One of the people behind the inaugural event is co-founder, the Reverend Julian Hamilton, who joins me in the studio. Julian, you're welcome. How's the countdown to the big event going?
I am just settling into my sleepless nights and last minute panic. Next Tuesday evening and all day next Wednesday in Trinity College is our first ever The Good Summit proper. We've just completed, my business partner, Amr Dawood, has just completed a half Good Summit and half We Share event in Egypt. So from nothing, by the end of the month, we will have two international events.
Now, there's no shortage of summits and meetings that people can go to. So what was the impetus or the drive for this, for both of you?
Honestly, there's a desire in both of us to see the world work differently. Amr was, he was a student whenever I first met him in Trinity. He was a member of the Muslim Society. And he burst into my office one day with a couple of others, and they were looking for help from the Christian chaplains with an auction at the end of Ramadan. And immediately, he's an incredibly charismatic and competent and good person. And so I was very willing to have that conversation, to do what I could. And then we became friends, and Amr would have taken part in some Christian Muslim student things that I did. I run a program called Space to Breathe, which gets together British, Irish on this island with Palestinians and Israelis from the Middle East. So, we became friends doing those sorts of things. And then during the devastating attacks in Paris, the Bataclan attack several years ago, Amr and I were both invited to speak by the Students' Union at a peace vigil in Front Square. And we both addressed an autumn crowd. We lit candles together. We talked about the need for peace in this world. And at the end of that, we just had a conversation. And I said, mate, we gotta do something. And he went, right, what are we going to do? And my love of gatherings and getting people together and the power of getting people together and what can happen whenever it's us and not just me. And Amr's love and ability of social enterprise and social responsibility, real civic engagement, those things just mesh together to become what we now know and call the Good Summit.
Now, we'll talk about some of the speakers that you've gathered together. But first, what I'd like to really explore a little bit further is and take you a little bit into the future. When this is all over and it's all done and you're breathing a big sigh of relief, how will you know it's been a good event?
That's a great question. I talk about this event as in trying to stimulate the conversation about what it means to do good, meaningful things within society. It's hard to say that one of our qualitative outcomes will be people will be more loving. But wouldn't it be great if they were? Wouldn't it be great if people were pushed towards more kindness and generosity and neighbourliness? Wouldn't it be great if the conversation concerning social responsibility took place in more deep ways between more people? So, for example, in the world of corporate social responsibility at the minute, it seems that there's a lot happening, but it's all internal. It's like the Christian church sometimes. You know, everybody's got their way forward. Everybody's got their idea for renewal and reform and what needs to happen now. But whenever we actually cross borders and get outside our own walls to have those conversations, something else happens. So we're trying to do that, trying to connect business, trying to connect students, trying to connect social entrepreneurs, trying to connect, you know, activists, anyone who's interested in how this world can work differently. We want them in the room because we believe that we're better together.
Julian, you're the Methodist chaplain in TCD, one of many chaplains down there. But in this particular case, I'm curious as to how your Methodist faith informs this summit.
I like to think, Michael, that whenever we talk about Methodism, I'm thinking about the one true faith.
You're getting your spoke in anyway.
That's working with priests over many years has taught me that.
Fight your corner.
The older I get, the more I get to cherish my Methodist roots. And I think that Methodism does two distinct things which it manages to hold together. We have this passionate, what in old days would have been called piety, but a real kind of lively, engaged, honest spirituality that comes from inside, a real kind of enthusiastic sense of who God is and what God calls us to, a very personal thing. And we actually hold that in completely the same place as a real social activism. Methodism, to be Methodism, it has to be engaged in the world in which it's situated. You know, so for my first 5 years, I was second minister in Dublin Central Mission on Abbey Street. We had 20 different nationalities every Sunday. And during the week, dozens and dozens of different groups and meetings taking place within the community there. So Methodism has to be involved in the local community. John Wesley, our founder, known as a vibrant firebrand preacher, you know, 30,000 miles on his horse, probably about several horses with those miles, actually. But at the same time as a passionate preaching, starting hospitals wherever he went, starting schools, we still have some of them in Ireland, Methody in Belfast, Wesley in Dublin, starting orphanages, starting widows' homes. And that's actually what he used his money for. The more he wrote, the more money he made from his writings, the more money he used for the care and the attention of the poor, for the education of the marginalised. So Methodism has to hold those two things together to be Methodist. So yeah, I cherish that.
Now, last week we had Mental Health Week, and I'm curious too about the idea that within a university setting, and you as a Methodist minister, how do you perceive the mental health state of the students around you? Are they sound?
11 years ago when I arrived in Trinity College, one of the things that I noticed was that Trinity really looked after its students. It really cared. It was a delight to begin to work in a place where I listened to the conversations and in the meetings I sat and thought, these guys care. The student services were really important. The health centre, sports centre, and the student counselling centre in particular, I thought and think is an excellent resource. I actually looked around at those times and thought, this is good. We'll kick this. This will be less of a problem. We look after students so well, the problems will disappear and we'll be more grounded. 11 years later, Michael, I have to say that anxiety, depression, serious mental health issues, they've only been on the rise. And I need to ask myself honest questions about what we are doing and how we are living in society that puts these pressures on young adults. But 10 years later, I did look around and say, there's more of these issues. And there was a while, to be honest, that I thought, if you build it, they will come. If you have a bigger counselling service, then of course more people are going to use it. The problems that were always there are just coming to the surface. I don't think that anymore.
I'm just thinking of a student who comes along to a chaplain, and the chaplain might say, well, you know, pray on it. I'm curious what John Wesley would have said if one of those students had the opportunity to ask Wesley what to do.
He would have said, pray on it. And then he would have said, now what can we do about it? He would have held both of those things together. And there's no doubt about it. Whenever you're a chaplain and you're talking to a student, you have the option that maybe some other student services don't. You can pray with people if it's appropriate. And some of the lovely interplay between, for example, again, the student counselling service and the chaplaincy would be whenever I get a phone call from a counsellor, happens regularly, or saying, I want you to talk with someone, because there's a particular spiritual aspect. There's a question of meaning or grief or deep loss or change of belief. And as you know, whenever somebody's beliefs are challenged and they want to hang on to them, it can be a really traumatic time. Almost regularly, I will get a student who sits in my office, a first-year student who's studying theology or religion or something like that, and they're a student of deep faith, and they will sit down towards the end of the first semester, usually, and they will say, do I have to lose my faith to keep studying religion here? Mm. And I will be very sympathetic, but inside I'm screaming, no! Mm. You know, learn to think. Don't be scared, because our faith, like every aspect of our lives, needs to grow. It needs to mature. If your faith stays static, then it's not real faith. You know, every aspect of our lives needs to continue to grow, and our faith is no exception to that.
Well, let's go back then to the Good Summit, mm-hmm. taking place mm-hmm. next week. Who are some of the speakers?
We've got over 40.
Wow.
Actually,
okay, we're going through that list.
Keynotes. I'm not telling them all.
Give us the headlines.
I'm really excited about the opening night. The opening night in the dining hall on Tuesday night. Two of our main things are that we are going to have Bertie Ahern sitting with David Blevins from Sky News. Mm. I can't mention Sky News.
You can, of course. Absolutely.
So David and Bertie are going to be in armchairs. And for about half an hour or 40 minutes, we will invite them to a conversation on the state of the world, talking about the Good Friday Agreement. I really want to hear David ask Bertie, what's it like whenever the buck really stops with you? Mm. What's it like to sit behind the desk and actually try to run a country? Is it possible to do good? Is it possible to have a desire to really see a country flourish for the good of all, or do other pressures crowd in? I'm sure we'll be talking about fake news as well at that, Brexit. There's a lot that conversation can handle. And then the next day we have four different streams. So after our morning plenary, we've got good health, good society, good work, and good leadership. And the Good Health stream is actually run by the World Health Innovation Summit. They'll be doing a panel on mental health, and Brezzy will be speaking on that panel. All that's happening throughout the day is designed to inspire, as well as challenge and give tools for the lives that we're leading in the world at the minute. Deirdre Mortel from the Social Innovation, from SIFI, Social Innovation Fund Ireland, is going to be Angela O'Connor, who started Trainability. I'm really excited also to hear Simon Anholt. He's the gentleman you might have heard of who started the Good Country Index. The first one he did, Ireland came top. Mm. Go us. Mm. We've fallen down the list in the last few years, sadly. But he has started a thing called Good Country. So he's inviting people to become citizens of the Good Country. And he outlines the values of what it might be if we're citizens of the world first, rather than citizens of a particular nation. So it's going to be fascinating listening to him as well. But a whole realm of things.
Who's it open to?
Open to everybody. Mm-hmm. There are still tickets left. You can still get tickets at thegoodsummit.com. And we are hoping, our aim was always to have roughly half students and half of industry people, you know, so activists, business people, entrepreneurs, social entrepreneurs. We wanted our students mixing with those people, again, because we're better together. So literally anybody is very welcome and will be very welcome.
Any worries about letting a genie out of a bottle, starting something that you mightn't be able to finish?
Well, here's the thing. Whenever you have conversations that matter, it tends to flourish, and it tends to seed and cultivate things that you maybe didn't foresee. So, as I say, this week, there has been an event in Egypt. The first Good Summit proper is next week. We're talking to people in Australia who want to do the Good Summit Australia next August. And we've been talking to people in America, maybe looking at early 2020. So, if we can make this event a regular occurrence in Dublin. And then how incredible it would be if conversations that matter about what it means to be good and generous and kind and hopeful with different and sustainable working practices are taking place all around the world.
Reverend Julian Hamilton, thanks for joining us on The Leap of Faith.
Thank you. Hussein, Hussein, Hussein.
Hussein, Hussein.
We love Karbala, we adore you, Hussein.
Hussein, 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 Hussein.
We love Karbala, we adore you, Hussein.
With the color of your love,
Hussein,
Hussein is written in our blood.
Hussein.
We love you, Karbala. We adore you, Hussein. Music from the Shia tradition, remembering the sacrifice of the grandson of the Prophet Muhammad in 680 AD. Well, this Sunday, in Dublin, the 12th annual Imam Hussein Condolence Conference will take place, and the chairperson and convener is Siraj Zaidi. Siraj, an unusual way to start a conversation with anyone, but what year is it?
2018 for Gregorian calendar, but Islamic calendar is 1440.
1440.
That's right. Islamic calendar is obviously started with the start of the Islam, which was initiated by the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. And so it's the year of, this is always a difference between AD and, you know, the Islamic calendar. So, yeah, I mean, it's a 500, almost 600 years, sort of like, you know, lacks the behind the Christian calendar.
Does it have an impact on day-to-day activities for you?
Not really, because obviously it runs parallel to people's life, and you do observe the Islamic calendar beginning with the first month of Muharram, which is unusual in the sense that in any other culture, and particularly in a Christian calendar, you have a massive celebration of New Year, New Year Eve and all that. Unlike that in Islam, we do not have that tradition. Particularly because of that incident that we're going to talk about it. And first month of Muharram is the month in which the grandson of Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, Hussein, as the third Shia Imam, in fact, it was not Shia at the time, there was no difference between Shia and Sunni. Him and his family and his followers have been trapped in a place called Karbala, which is very famous now in Iraq, a city called. And he was slain mercilessly by the forces of so-called Muslims of the time. They were Muslims, but wrongly guided. Political divisions had been deeply cleaved at that time, and he was being massacred. So the community who followed that, and not only him, the persecution started from his father, from his brother Hassan, older brother. So the persecution continued during their lifetime, and that reached to a time when the ruler tyrant at the time, Yazid, enforced the oath of allegiance on him. And he said, look, I'm now in power. He violated the treaty which was signed by his father, Muawiyah, by the older brother of Hussein, Hassan, Imam Hassan, who was a second imam. So there were parallel forces at that time running side by side who followed so-called the tyrannical rules and so-called the pious leadership.
It is interesting looking at it from a Christian perspective that you would say, you know, here are two groups of people who, even after hundreds of years, are still in a schism. They're still separated from each other. What efforts are made or are any made to bring them together?
Great efforts have been made lately after the post-revolution of the Iran, in fact, which was, say, the Islamic Revolution of Iran. They do huge amount of work throughout the year, and not they, but all throughout the Europe and North America and everywhere. People are trying to actually come to a consensus that, look, guys, you have to work peace with each other and make a peace effort. So there is a conferences, what call the intra-faith conferences among Muslims, where the gatherings of Taqrib conference, they call it, a proximity among the Islamic thoughts. So there's a great consensus, that the great work is going on, and people are working together to make that difference, narrow it down, and in fact face the challenge of the world. But sometimes the evil forces do prevail. you know.
That's something you're aware of. You say the new year starts around September, I think, isn't that the...
It's a lunar calendar, so it changes. It's variable. Mm. Now it starts in September, and so it's a 10 days moves every year. Mm. And it's the first month of Muharram. So there are 12 months. Muharram, Safar, Rabiul Awwal, Rabiul Thani, Jamadi Awwal, Jamadi Thani, etc. Then comes Ramadan. That's the name of the month. Ramadan, Rajab, Shaban. These are the names of the month, about 12 months. And that in that order, you would have a month of Muharram, which is the very first month, that followed by the month
and
of Safar.
And as you say, that month is full of sorrow and it's full of remembrance.
It's a remembrance, grief. It's a time of, reflecting back the history of Islam. So it's a complete time to rehaul yourself and thoughts that what happened and reflect that. So particularly the followers of and the family of Prophet Muhammad, family of Hussein, which are very much around us in 14 generations. I'm one of them. In fact, I come from the same lineage. We are Sayyid. Sayyid are the people who followed. So it's a matter of remembering, our great-grandfather's history, what happened to our lot.
As we said at the beginning, we're looking at the year 1440, so it's not that deep a lineage that you have to go back.
Absolutely, it's not. It's only about 13 generations we're talking about.
I'm curious for you as a member of a faith that has grief as one of its founding experiences and something as tragic as you describe it, does that leave room for joy?
Oh, indeed. Throughout the year it is. I mean, the joy starts after 2 months. So the 2 months are sort of like, so to speak, a mourning month. After that, the celebration happens. And again, it's linked with the celebration of what happened to the remaining member of the Hussein's family who's been slain. His only sick and child, or I would say a youth, the fourth Imam, Imam Zain al-Abidin, who survived, his name was Imam Sajjad. And he, when the revenge was taken of the killer of his father and the army guy came back and he said, look, please smile. The revenge has been taken. Your children, your family, your people has been. And he said, I might smile a tiny bit, but that's not going to bring my 18 brothers. Mm.
And as we're even talking, you're experiencing that grief. That grief is still present.
It's a human nature. Mm. Human nature that you, if you are reviving that pain every year, you become more compassionate, more humane. You relate to the pain of others, the suffering of others, because you remember. Here is the pain of a gruesome tragedy that took place, and this is the description of that gruesome tragedy that people talk about it and talk about it very passionately. This tradition, I must say, that continued and lived on today because of the sister, again the women role, people talk about women in Islam, the sister of Hussein who survived that massacre, her name was Zainab continued that, and when she was released from the prisoner of Yazid, because they become prisoner of war, the women and children at the time, their rule was kill all the men and keep women and children as a prisoner of war. So when she got relieved from the prison of Yazid, she demanded, she said, I need a house, I need a place where I can mourn for my brother. Mm. And I gather together the women and the area, and I talk about this tragedy. That what happened to him was injustice. A pious man was being slain because he was forced to sign an oath of allegiance from a tyrant.
But sitting here in a studio with you and you're viscerally reacting to a memory of a whole people.
A distant memory.
A distant memory.
Yeah.
And then at the same time, you would look at the idea of reconciliation, of bringing people together and of coming under again one direction. Now, to that end, there's a practical reaction that you're doing because this Sunday, you're actually convening and chairing a conference. Tell us more about that.
Yeah. I mean, I've started this conference about 12 years ago. It's called the Annual Imam Hussein Conference of Ireland. And it's my effort to actually talk about the event and to work with the interfaith community, which I'm very much part of it. I'm founder of Three Faith Forum of Ireland, between Jews, Muslims and Christians in Ireland. And we also have a now, in the last few years, the Dublin Interfaith Forum. And so my effort is always to bring speakers from the different faiths and, you know, talk about it, let them prepare a little paper, and they can present a little paper so we can actually understand what's going on around us today and bring forward that history of Islam, which many people do not understand. And they wonder around why these people do what they do. So therefore, this is an effort in the conference to a very important element is to actually educate our youngsters, the youth of our society, and bring the secondary school kids to prepare the paper. And they work around, and they, so this is happening this Sunday. So it's every year we do, and it's a half day seminar. People present papers, they talk about it, they intermingle as a bit of chit-chat and basically learn about something which is a very, very important part of the history.
Who's it open to?
It's open to everybody. It's anybody can walk in. It's free. So most welcome, anybody who's listening, anybody who's interested, 2 o'clock in the Miltown and Hassania Hall. And it's primarily obviously a lot of Shia people and Muslim people. This year, I'm grateful that Dublin Mosque people are coming, which belongs to a different tradition than Shia tradition. But the administrator, Mr. Muzaffar Al-Thawash, who's a colleague of mine, I would say a very gentleman from the Interfaith Forum, who's also attending with his brothers. So we'd really like to have this cohesion, and my effort has always been to have a peace and cohesion in this society where we live in, and therefore have no kind of so-called international tensions which are out there in a bigger world, so-called Middle East, and to reflect in our society. Unfortunately, sometime, you know, the single voices are weak voices, but sometime when the voices get collective voices, they become stronger. So they can, you can actually confront the bigger complex problems.
The relevance of Karbala and Imam Hussein and his peace efforts, the conference is the 12th annual conference, is taking place this Sunday. And details will be on our website as well. Siraj Seedi, thank you for joining us on The Leap of Faith.
Many thanks for having me on the show.
Finally this week, there is no God. Well, that's the conclusion of the celebrated physicist Stephen Hawking, whose final book, Brief Answers to the Big Questions, was published this week. The book, which was completed by his family after his death, presents answers to the questions that Hawking said he received most during his time on Earth. Other bombshells the British scientist left his readers with include the belief that alien life is out there, artificial intelligence could outsmart humans, and time travel can't be ruled out. Hawking, considered one of the most brilliant scientists of his generation, died in March at the age of 76. That's The Leap of Faith for this week. Join us next week at the same time, when among our guests will be the author John Scali, who shares his insight into beautiful thoughts for the beautiful mind. From all of us here tonight, good night.